This is like money in the bank.
That's funny, I said the bill, there's some order. We had a bill we were hearing last Friday when we had the adjournment. And I wanna get those that were not able to testify, and I'll call first on Representative Dr. Howard Cherry.
How was it, Roger?
$658, the intermediate education district bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, these members. I'm sure you're tired of hearing about this bill. I'd like to give you just a sentence of my background in regard to IEDs. I happen to be president of the Oregon School Board Association when most of the law as IEDs are now governed was passed by the legislature, and Tom Rigby and I did a good deal of work on this thing, and I have been acquainted with it since. I've been an IED board member and am yet for several years. The IEDs have lots of defects. The law goes back in which there are county schools really since the start of the state, and it has changed from the emphasis on the county superintendent to the old rural law, and now the IEDs. The function of IED now is essentially a board to help school boards. It has little contact actually with the individual student or the individual voter, and the programs are supplied, as you know, in two ways. One, by contracts to school districts, in which a district may actually pay from its funds to have a service performed, and this bill does not speak of this function. This bill speaks of two other functions. One is the administrative expenses, and this term has been used rather loosely in this hearing, and the other is resolutions. Now, the administrative expenses are the actual expenses of just the top administrators, and in doing these portions of the law that are required, such as reporting, certifying teachers, and so forth. The big item, or the item I think that is important in this bill, is that of resolutions. And as you know, this is a manner in which the same service can be supplied to every district in the IED by two-thirds of the districts. That is, the boards of two-thirds of the districts, representing over half of the students, may ask for this, and then this is taken out of the IED levy. The IED levy then contains by far the greatest amount is the equalization fund, the administrative funds, and the resolution fund. And the resolution funds actually are rather small amounts. They'll vary from district to district. The district, the IED that I know the most about, of course, is Multnomah County, which is probably the most active district and gives the most services of any district. And in Multnomah County, the amount of money per pupil spent through the IED in the administrative and resolution is $15 per student, compared to almost $1,000 a student spent by the in operations by the school, by the local school district, which really means that this does not amount to very much money in proportion to the total amount. The effects of this bill are such that it would be impossible to have any single significant addition to programs without a vote of the people. And in general, these are programs that the people are not well informed on. The boards if the boards want these programs, they ask for them, and it is the board's choice, really, when it comes down to it, as to whether they want a single program or would rather have the equalization for that same amount of money. And as a generality, they will choose the programs that they want to give that can be given cheaper and better at the IED level than at the local level. This bill will affect small districts and inactive IEDs, or relatively inactive IEDs, much more than large districts or full-service IEDs, because the proportion, what you could do within 6% each year, would almost do nothing in a small district, while a large district it would give more you could get more programs in under that 6%. You asked the question the other day about the trainable mentally retarded. That would be an example that no district anywhere in the state could possibly put in under this present law. It would increase the budget over 6%. It would be one that would comply with the legislature's request. It would be one that would be hard to sell to on a voter basis. Do you ask the amount of money that goes, that the IEDs and the state put in Multnomah County in the current budget? The state contribution to trainable retarded is $150,000 and the IED contribution is $190,000. A technicality that would appear if this bill passes that is not present in any other manner in the state, and I believe is undesirable, is that in the same budget, you would be applying two different 6%. You have 6% limitation now by law on the whole budget, and then if you put this in, essentially you're putting a 6% additional on a single line item, which are a part of the overall budget. I think you asked the question the other day what the equalization was doing when the administrative and resolution parts were going up at a rather large amount. In Multnomah County, over a 10-year period, the IED tax rate has remained almost identical. It's a few hundred percent. In 1962, the tax rate was $4.90 per thousand evaluation, and in 1971-72, it's $4.89 per $1,000 evaluation. And this, of course, includes the equalization and the other items. Now, on the tax offset, which is equalization, in 10 years ago, in 62-63, the amount of tax equalization, or the whole item, this is just equalization, is $138 per student in the IED district. 10 years later, it's $205, which is an increase over 10 years of about 80-90%. Again, I think the important factors here, really in consideration, is whether you should have either legislative or a vote of the people on actual curriculum programs. And it has been the policy for as long as I've known the legislature to, as far as possible, stay out of this, and also that the people do not vote on curriculum programs. And the only exception that I know of is kindergarten. Under the law, as it has been for some years, kindergarten would require a vote of the people. You might be interested in what programs are provided by resolutions in Multnomah County. There are 9 programs, which I believe is the highest in the state. And I'll just name them, and I would like, as I name them, have you think about whether these are desirable, as the every year by resolution the districts in the county have indicated they were, and whether you think it would be easy to sell to the people or even possible to sell to the people. The first program listed is Trainable Mentally Retarded. The second is Edgefield Lodge School, which is a school for disturbed youngsters. The third is an audiovisual program. The fourth is an attendance services that lets district number one and all the rest that work together rather than separately. The next is a computer education program. This uses the IED computers as a instruction in classes and has an extension in each of the high schools. A testing program, outdoor education, Donald E. Long School, that is the education program for the Donald E. Long School, and the Wynn Watt School, which is an educational program for the school for pregnant girls. Now, I believe that concludes my presentation. I would say that if you think this bill is desirable, that it would certainly be much more acceptable, and I believe more fair, if it did limit itself to the administrative cost and instead of the administrative plus the resolution services. I would be glad to try to answer any questions you have. I realize the time is very short today.
Dr. Cherry, we have some figures, and I asked for figures comparative-wise, and I just gave us figures for 5970 on all accounting, a breakdown of the various parts of the IED budget. Is there a 6% limitation on the overall budget now?
No. Yes, that is correct. That includes equalization, yes.
What happens when, as an example, in Clackamas County, a ballot measure put out to exceed the 6% by a sizable margin and fails? And they drop back to their budget of the previous year plus 6%. And what happens if we've expanded by resolution these programs, computer programs or anything else? Does that come out of the IED?
That does come out, yes. That would come directly out of what otherwise is equalization. And please note that this is a conscious decision and a year-by-year decision of two-thirds of the districts in the county. Each of these resolutions is reviewed each year, and they do have the opportunity to withdraw anyone they want or modify anyone they want.
Tony, you talked about the increase in equalization. You cited some figures in about a 10-year period.
In Multnomah County, now I don't have the state figures.
Well, let's use Multnomah as an example.
All right.
And then equalization has gone from what to what?
Per child equalization has gone from $138 to $205.
That's in a
10-year period.
Now, how much of the administrative and resolution costs are from that 10-year period?
Proportionately, very much higher. I don't have a figure. I presume it's 400 or 500%. But still, at the 1970 level, we're only spending $15 compared to almost $1,000 spent on the child in operation. So what we're while it's gone proportionately in itself, a very large amount, the amount compared to the total cost of educating a child is still very low.
And you don't have a figure for what it was per child 10 years ago in the administration?
I don't know where it is. It might be in here somewhere, but I don't know where it is. But I'm sure that it's several hundred percent. My guess would be maybe 40% more in 10 years, which is a reflection of the service that they do. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 658?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to say a few words.
Okay. Senator Groner.
I'm Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. I'm on the Clackamas County ID, and one thing that concerns me, we have taken over the funding, as you know, of the mentally retarded school at the Holcomb School. Also, we have a plan now by resolution to have computers in 13 high schools in Clackamas County. This we couldn't do if this bill had passed. I oppose the bill in the Senate. I think it's in it, Dr. Cherry has said, we are under 6% limitation overall. It does take some from equalization, which I think is very important to adopt programs that are a benefit to the youngsters throughout the county if it's approved by two-thirds of the board of over representing over 50% of the youngsters in the school. That me concerned, we have some real excellent programs that have been adopted in my county, and without which we couldn't have done if this bill were passed.
Senate Bill 656, Mr. Strother.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Strother. I live in Milwaukee, Clackamas County, president of the Reagan Building Association. I'm here speaking in behalf of Senate Bill 656. It was introduced at our request by Senator Groner. It's been modified and amended. And you'll notice that primarily it's more or less a tool to give the state engineer some or a further tool to reinforce his position in the Groundwater Act of 1955, in enforcing the Groundwater Act of 1955. And we think it's a good bill, and we've worked with the Agriculture Subcommittee and amended it, and we have to request that you pass it on for it.
Did you just,
Go ahead. We just passed a bill the other day that required
Senate Bill 558.
All well drillers to be licensed. What's the...
Oh, 558 didn't require... All welders have to be licensed under the Groundwater Act of 1965. Or so.
Yeah. They have to be licensed to drill on their own property.
Well, this is 558. They have to get a bond, furnish a bond to the state engineer. But Senate Bill 656 doesn't have anything to do with individual landowners who own their own drilling machine. 656 pertains to individuals who want to become well drilling contractors. And the way the law is written now, anybody that can pass a comprehensive exam given by the state engineer can become a contractor without any experience whatsoever.
How is a fellow going to get experience?
He can either run a drilling machine as a licensed drilling operator, or he can have in his employ a man who has at least 2 years of experience.
This is going to require that he have 4 years of experience.
It's actually been amended to where it has 2 years, so this is just a mistake in the printing here.
How are you going to drill a well for 2 years if you can't do it unless you're licensed?
You can...
Is that an apprenticeship program? Or
apprenticeship programs, or you can be a licensed machine operator for 2 years, or employ a man who has had 2 years of experience. What the industry is trying to do is get some knowledge into the drilling industry. The way the law is written now is that well, like you yourself, if you decide to become a drilling contractor, you can get the rules and regulations of the state engineer and take a comprehensive exam and become a licensed drilling contractor. This doesn't mean you know anything about drilling a well. I mean, there's more to drilling a well than reading a book. You have to have some experience. The electricians have the same thing. The plumbers have actually the same thing. And now we'd like to have the drilling, if you're a drilling contractor.
They drill wells without people drill wells or dig wells without knowing anything about
this is true.
Now Eugene is driving pipe down a spring, you drive a pipe down the ground to get water.
This is true. And Groundwater Act of 1955 says the legislative assembly recognizes, declares, and finds that the right to reasonable control of all water within this state from all source water supply belongs to the public, and that in order to ensure the preservation of the public welfare, safety, and health is necessary. Then they would provide the provision that you people set up by the legislature, that the state engineer is going to make up rules and regulations. And this is what you do when you license drilling contractors, that they're supposed to do that, but they don't know how to do it. This is where the problems come. And the state engineer has run into more problems with people becoming drilling contractors having no knowledge of how to drill out. We had an instance where mail order Montgomery Ward became a drilling contractor. And they got themselves into much trouble to find equipment. Before they did quit, they were in violation of their
standards. Well, is this making a closed corporation?
No, sir, it is not making a closed corporation. Because if you want to become a drilling contractor and have had no experience, you can hire a man to work for you that has one. Who is a licensed drilling machine operator? The last thing from the closed corporation. It's just that it reinforces the Groundwater Act in that a man must have some experience in how to drill a well.
How about digging a well?
This is money for licensed drilling contractors. The rules and regulations state that here a man digging a well is not covered.
Bob, there's going to be concern. I have some on page 5, the penalties that are prescribed. You jump the minimum from $50 to $250 and a maximum up to $1,250.
Yes, well,
we've just gone through the criminal law revision code and we've seen criminal penalties prescribed that are less than this.
Mm-hmm.
I guess these are criminal penalties.
Well, they should be, but the way the district attorneys throughout the state have been handling, they just kind of brush them off as it's too small for us to bother with, so they neglect to do this. And by raising penalties, we felt that it would make it more mandatory that they prosecute. In your own county, there have been two instances where the state engineer has requested that the district attorney proceed against two violations of rules and regulations, and he said it was too small a deal for him. In Grant County, they had to finally go to the Justice of the Peace to get him to proceed on the violation. So this just raises the worst worthwhile. This is the billing industry asking these clients, their own people, to be fined. This isn't the billing industry asking anything but something to be imposed upon themselves.
I can't speak for the district attorney in Clackamas County. Maybe Senator Vernon is talking about it, but I'm not sure he'd prosecute it even at this level if he didn't want it.
Well, if you read on line 7, it adds a little more to there that it's
shall prosecute.
It shall.
Well, if that's so, then you don't really need to defend it that way.
You know, we have the only piece that the state engineer has now, due to the fact he doesn't have the cooperation of the district attorney, is he can suspend a zoning contractor's license for a period of time. But this hasn't been of any benefit to anybody. And so it's been the association's feeling that if one contractor were slapped a good penalty of about $1,000 to $1,200, it's the only place that really hurts is in pocket. And this would clean up all the deficiencies that exist in the zoning at this present time.
I'd like to clarify a couple of things. Right now, if a person wants to be a well driller, he's got to take a competitive exam by the state engineer, right?
Yes.
Is he required to re-examine?
No. Once he passes the exam, he's required to post a $2,000 bond and renew it every year. But once he passes the examination,
Now, it's your contention that that examination bears no relevance to being able to well drill well.
It's my contention the examination covers the groundwater at probably to the highest degree. And you can read the rules and regulations, you can see the engineer, and you can pass the exam. And you know everything there is to know that's been put in that book. But it doesn't get the job of doing it. And
well,
this is where you come unstuck.
My answer would be, why don't you make the exam so that you know how to drill a well, instead of what appears to me kind of a way of closing up the industry?
This isn't closing up the industry, because all the contractors' exam entails is knowing the Groundwater Act, but it has nothing whatsoever to do with how you proceed to operate the drilling machine to do this. And this is why you have the drill operator's exam. But you can be a licensed drilling contractor, and you don't have to be a licensed drill operator, the way the law is written now.
I confess I have a hang up on experience requirements and licensing laws and severe penalties in place of a competitive exam. Now, if the exam isn't relevant to what you need to do, then you should make the exam relevant. But frankly, I'm very apprehensive about setting up that he has to have two years of experience drilling the thing before he can even get started.
He can get started anytime. Anybody that wants to get into the electrical contracting business can put up a sign, but they have to have an employee, a supervisor, and this is all we're asking for in the drilling business. We're asking for experience.
Should that be 2 years there on line 15?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where should it be 2 years at its core?
Well, there's an amendment in the State House or the Senate Agriculture Committee amended that to 2 years. And it just never got ground into the printing. If you'd like to spend the time, I can cite quite a few cases where people have become licensed drilling contractors and wish they hadn't because they didn't have the experience in how to we have a licensed drilling contractor firm out of Walla Walla, Washington. They were called in on 5 counts of violations of the rules and regulations, and the licensed drilling contractor was a real estate dealer and never seen them before. And this is what we're saying.
Well, it just seemed to me that someone who is in real estate doesn't know anything about drilling a well and passing the exam, then you should do something about this.
I didn't write the examination. I didn't write the law. I just tried to get somebody to amend it to where it's usable in the industry.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Senator Braun.
I have left. Okay. John Meeker. Chairman, gentlemen of the committee. I'm John Meeker from Newburgh, Oregon. I've been in the well drilling business in Willamette Valley for the past 25 years. I'll try not to be repetitious and not cover the ground that Bob's already covered. There seems to be some misunderstanding on what it takes to be a water well driller and a contractor and a drill operator. As of today, you have to work 1 year under a licensed drilling operator to become a drilling machine operator. Now let me give you an example. I have a young fellow working for me who has worked almost a year. In July, he'll be eligible to become a drill operator, licensed drill operator. And he's sharp. He can go down and get study the book and get a drilling contractor's license. He has somebody to back him for the bond. He's a drilling contractor, as of the way the law is written now. But he's 20 years old. His money runs to sports, girls, cars, probably in that. But he's a good, sharp young man. You wouldn't want him to drill you a well, I'm sure. I'm sure of that because his mind is just not on it. But this is legal. What we're asking is simply that he have 2 years after he becomes licensed, experienced. Then he's eligible to become a contractor. This is simply all we're asking. 2 years experience. And I'm sure that after he's licensed and given 2 years of experience, that he'd be a reasonably good driller and could do a reasonably good job. Or, if you want to become a contractor, you're not shut out by this bill. You simply need to hire someone who has the 2 years experience as a licensed drill operator. And as to this gentleman's question over here, that the examination should be made to reflect his experience and knowledge. Sometimes this just isn't hardly possible when you drill as many varied formations under as many different conditions as well drilling operation is. You drill rock, gravel, sand, etc., on and on. And sometimes I think there should be a better way, but to my knowledge, this isn't. I don't know of a better way. And this probably is the easiest craft there is to get into yet. You can talk about your electrical contractors, your plumbing, your carpenter, etc., etc., and there's just nothing that you can get into with as little experience as you can into the well-drilling business. And we feel that it's a very important craft, and we feel that it needs people with more experience in the responsible positions for it.
Pretty far back. Well. Yes, my name is Walt Wilson. I'm Vice President of the Oregon Drilling Association. I don't want to dwell too long on it because I know you're tired of it. But there's one point that I think should be brought out that hasn't been mentioned. And one of the biggest ills of not having experienced people in the drilling industry as contractors are these are the people that's going to create the problem of polluted water, groundwater, in the future. Groundwater is something you cannot take pollutant out of. It's not like our streams. If you let the groundwater become polluted, it's going to be polluted. You're not going to get back your groundwater. The other point is that the people in the industry today is gradually dwindling down to nothing. In 1955, when the groundwater law went into effect, we had something like 300 and some contractors. Last year we had 226. This year we have 112. And every year we have anywhere from 15 to 20 new contractors pass the examination to become contractors. But by the same token, we are still dwindling off to nothing. And so there's nothing in the law or anything that's helping the industry. The law is there, but we need more support, more means of enforcing some of it. And this is the only thing that the industry is trying to do is preserve itself. I don't think that if we're trying to make a closed corporation, in any sense of the word, you cannot be a drilling contractor unless you have some knowledge of it. There's no way that you can do it. If there's any questions you can think, I'll answer otherwise.
What do you offer?
Springfield, Eugene A.
Any other questions? How would that pollution occur?
How it would occur? By improper steel wells. Let your agriculture pesticides and things leach into the groundwater structure, any bad pollutant of any sort from septic tanks, rivers, polluted that gets in the ground structure and seeps into your pure groundwater below.
Thank you very much,
Mr. Did you all agree that that should be 2 years? There was an energy assessment to read 2 years. Maybe 9:15. That's page 2. Page 4 to 2. You get the amendments to that on the
next meeting? I can do that, yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Chris Wheeler, State Engineer of Oregon, appearing here in favor of Senate Bill 656. I think most of what I might say you've already heard explained here as to what the bill does. And I don't want to take your time repeating it. The drilling industry did have this bill developed, and as it's amended, or was amended by the Senate, I'm fully in support of it. The details of what happened on this phase 2, line 15, I'm not sure, but I do know that the Senate committee had amended it from the original 4 down to 2, but it didn't get cratered in this bill. And if it takes an amendment, I would be happy to get an amendment over to you. I'd speak to one thing here. The original Groundwater Act and the licensing of the well drillers contemplated that the contractor would not necessarily have experience. And Representative Densmore, in making up the exams and administering the law, the state engineer's office has chosen to follow the wording of the law and the intent that it was made the time it was passed. And therefore, our license examination for contractors does not really go to the picture of trying to say that he is an experienced well driller. We do that in the separate examination that's given for a machine operator's license. Well, I won't say that any exam is perfect. At least this is the concept, and this is the reason why we have not in the past tried to make the contractor's license also cover the experience. Now, if you would pass this law and this amendment, we would modify our exam, and we would then also have in it more tending to answer the question of whether he was knowledgeable as in the drilling profession. In essence, the same requirement exists in part today. A contractor who is just a businessman who knows all the requirements of the law has to have a licensed machine operator to run the rig. Quite important. But that licensed machine operator is just that. He has to have had a year's experience in drilling and training for drilling in order to get that license. And this would mean that he would have to have had more experience in drilling, more time to have run up against the many and varied problems. Geologically, Oregon is a very, very varied state. Most of it is igneous in origin, basalt, lava rock, but we do have an awful lot of alluvium and sand and gravel too. And the difference between these different formations and in different parts of the state can be extremely great. Even 10 years experience wouldn't be enough to cover in all of it. I believe that's all I have to say. I hope I answered some representative.
I've got a question that's kind of at a half angle to this. What is the state water master? Why is he in Washington County instead of state?
We don't actually have a state water master as such. The water master system, and there are 15 of them throughout the state, are employees of the state engineer. This happens to be a job title that historically has been in there. There is one located at Hillsboro covering that district, which includes Kilmer. The state is divided up into 15 water districts to provide this service. If you wanted to say a head state water master, why, you'd have to say that was the state engineer or the employee in my office who's head of that division.
I received a complaint from a patient of mine, and I have to know something about it. It seriously one of the preposterous bureaucratic enforcement of a ridiculous regulation. It's going to make a guy tear a dam down because the water isn't running. Well, they're arguing about whether this little sump, kind of the marshy area, is a stream or not. And what the dam provides is a little wildlife refuge that is very valuable. It's on the East Coast Bay area. and the water master or the fellow in Hillsborough, by God, you're going to tear that dam down because it says that OR such and such line such and such, you're not complying with the law. So there. And it's one of those things that kind of gets me going a little. I'd like to chat with you about it.
I would be happy to chat with you about it at your convenience, Representative Martin. I would like to have an opportunity to find out where and what we're talking about before trying to answer the details.
I'll give you the whole file.
That'll take much to get him going.
Any further questions? Wait, just a couple. Could you describe for me the exam that goes on now? What is it totally written?
For the contractor's exam? Well, primarily, the contractor's exam covers the rules and regulations and the statutes that pertain to the groundwater law, the responsibilities of the contractor, the requirements that he has to meet, the reports he has to make, and what he has to do. I can get you a copy if you want a copy of one of the exams, although if I furnish it to you, I would ask that you not make it available to other people who might be interested in passing the exam. We don't make it a public as such.
No, I'm interested in what you do. The statutory reference that you're talking about that gives you power to set up such an exam tells you then that you didn't have a place experience.
No, sir, it does not say this in this kind of language. The statute was passed covering both the machine operators and the contractors at the same time by the same legislature.
If you drop an examination for both.
That's correct.
Well, I don't follow that if the statute says that you set up an exam, then how do you justify different criteria for each one? Is there something else in the statute that makes you do that or what?
Well, there's one section of the law and one statute that says that you'll set up an exam for a drilling machine operator and that it will be to test his experience and capability of drilling wells. The section passed at the same time as a part of the same bill, the same law for contractors. And there it says we shall be set up to test the contractor for his knowledge required for the operation of the business. Now, you can say that this, barely in the language of it, would be broad enough that you could include the capability to drill in it. Nevertheless, at the time it was passed, there were hearings in both the Senate and the House before committees such as this, in which the discussions were held, and the concept was that the contractors would be on the one hand tended towards the technical end of the business, not the actual machine operation, and that the requirements on a machine operation would be covered under that bill also. Obviously, under the present law, if you just have a contractor's license, you still have to have a machine operator employee license. This is more following the history of the development of the original act than it is in the specific language of the law.
Any further questions? Thank you, Chris. Paige will be back in a couple minutes with the copies and the waypoint. Copies of those.
Thank you.
Bill 314, Representative Reese. Okay. Isn't 314 the one we've amended?
I presented the amendment, Mr. Chairman, but it hasn't been.
1525. Senate Bill 314 as it came from the Senate to Thursday, Friday, has not been heard yet by the committee. But I did present amendments to 314 to make it conform with 1525.
What will it do in addition to that? I think we're all prepared to support your amendments to 1525, and we can put them in here. Does the bill do anything beyond that? No. The amendments which were prepared and attached to 1525 were amendments to Senate Bill 314. adapted to 1525. The amendments that I have presented to you are adapted to 314 and would accomplish the same result.
Okay. What else is the bill written? Are you that familiar?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Very familiar with it. Senate Bill 314 is the result of long work and effort by many organizations and the Senate Education Committee. It makes numerous and I think constructive changes in the present law for the consultations with teachers and between teachers and school boards. Precisely, defines what it is to confer and consult and discuss in good faith and put that definition into the law. We feel it's needed. There are many boards who are seem to be vague about what is intended in the intent of the legislature on the mutual obligation to meet, the endeavor to reach agreement, and the effort to follow through and implement the agreements that are made. It separates teachers and administrators by categories for purposes of consultation. It broadens the scope from the present definition, which is simply reads matters of salaries and economic policies affecting professional service. This broadens the scope of discussion to include grievance procedures and compensation beyond the normal duties for which the teacher or administrator is employed. And the amendments, which I brought to you, make a change in Senate Bill 314, which was which amended the present law to say salaries, hours, and working conditions. That broad definition was not acceptable to the board, and we submitted the grievance procedures and compensation beyond the normal duties, which was satisfactory to the teaching profession. This provides for individual representation in a district that employs 10 or fewer teachers. It establishes procedures which allow a committee to be chosen, a committee of teachers from the or administrators from the school district, or it allows the representation to be elected by organization. It allows the board to it changes the shall that presently the law states that the board shall conduct the election. This says the board may conduct the election or may designate someone to conduct the election. That really is something that many school boards are already doing, so it makes it legal, I would expect. Then it defines how the elections to determine representation shall be shall proceed. There shall be an opportunity each year. The election shall be conducted by the board or designee. It may be called at the request of an organization, either by certifying that the organization has a membership of at least 40%, or by petition containing signatures of 30% of eligible employees. Committees can be placed on the ballot in the same manner, and any employee organization, such as your young church, may intervene by filing a petition signed by 10% of eligible employees. It defines the number of elections, which is one of the things that needed to be done. That is, if no employee organization receives a majority of the vote, the next ballot shall contain only the highest and the next highest vote. And it has limited elections to not more than one per year. It further provides that those elections shall be within that initial 30-day period of the school year. The amendment to 314, the next amendment, 314, which is a change from the original, is that it? This requires the board to prepare a budget calendar. And I found no one who was in disagreement with this. We just didn't manage to get it into Senate Bill 314, which states that 60 days before the budget message date, if agreement is not reached, mediation is invoked. Previous to this, the law has simply stated whenever the two parties find that they are in disagreement, then you begin to go through the process of mediation. This says that 60 days prior to the budget message, if agreement has not been reached, you go into the mediation period. Mediation and fact-finding replaced the old impasse panel, which proved to be both awkward and very expensive, and places a 35-day limit on the mediation and fact-finding process, during which time we have provided in here that consultation may continue. But 25 days prior to the budget message, the process must be completed. This, I think, is a distinct improvement and allows a period of time during which the same people who are responsible for the budget and the school program and the levy election can have time to prepare for the levy election. If requested by either party, agreements reached shall be written, which is changed from present law, and it requires the board to provide a procedure for determining employee views on issues other than those in the scope of consultation. And that is now a requirement in the law, although it's in them. I had been under the impression that all good boards did that, but apparently all boards do not, and this requires that they make that kind of opportunity available to the staff. The Senate Bill 314 had a provision that's called voluntary arbitration, which meant that the procedure could be jointly submitted to an impartial third party for a final and binding arbitration, and then because of that had a detailed list of management rights. The difference in the amendments which we have presented simply goes back to the original statement, which is, however, nothing in this section is intended to affect the powers and duties of the district school board, and we have deleted that long laundry list of management rights.
Mary, nothing prevents this contemplate to go more than one time, so you have more than one disagreement. Right. In other words, the process can be mediated several times. In other words, let's say we have mediation and then the budget goes down, and then you reopen, negotiations again, and then there's another disagreement, you do the same process again and again, right?
Well, usually the agreements are based upon, they have to be, based upon levy elections. I think sports and teachers doing a good job would have that kind of contingency in their original agreement, which I think would make it possible for the whole process of running schools to proceed in a more orderly manner. But I see nothing in this law that would say you couldn't agree to meet and renegotiate if the money goes down. Because that was, you still have to have another budget election. But I think the on another budget message and another budget hearing. But I think you ought to leave yourself time before any such election to get your budget election on the road.
Further questions?
When we were talking about 1525, there seemed to be an agreement from all parties concerned, and Representative Howe and several others, and so forth, all agreed. Is there that same kind of agreement on 314?
With these amendments, it's the same bill.
Same bill.
At the time we brought in 1525, the Senate Bill 314 had been returned to committee by the Senate, subsequently it came out again and was passed by the Senate, and so we're saying in these amendments.
Well, 314 is broader in scope than 1525, is it not?
It was broader in scope than the original 1525. 1525, as amended in this committee, became Senate Bill 314, in effect.
This is another one of these bills that I'm going to support, but I don't agree with the way it's
amended.
Well, the amended the way it's handled, because 315 was 314 was sent back to committee over there, and the identical bill is putting over the House and hopes it'll go through and go over there. I think that. And one bill put in the Senate, why then if it dies over there, it could die over we're getting billed continually through here, that it's identical bill, only one foot in one house and one foot the other. And if my theory is that the Senate doesn't accept the first bill, after we go to all the work to send over it, they're not going to accept what we're sending over anyway, if they're against it.
I hope they will. We have pretty good indication that they will. And the reason for this, and I agree with your view on those, this identical bill and the process that you object to, I agree with you about this. The important thing here is that we very much need improvement in this consultation process.
I'm doing what I'm doing here
in the hope that we can achieve an improvement that can be accepted in the House as well as in the Senate.
I just hope this builds a little backbone into some of the school boards, but I doubt it will.
We intend that it will be.
Well, I hope so.
That's it. Would you like to make a motion to amend Senate Bill 314?
I would move that we amend Senate Bill 314 with the amendments of, is that right, May 28th? What date did it
begin? May 28th.
May 28th.
I have one question on the amendment.
Well, let me state the motion. Representative Howard moves that the amendment stated May 28th be passed to Senate Bill 314.
On the first page of the amendment, it says in line 2, or line 12 of page 2, delete 2 and 3. I don't find it 2 and 3. Is that supposed to be the insert from the insert 3?
Amendment says on line 12, delete 2 and 3. And I'm sure it should say delete 2 and insert 3.
It should say delete 2 and insert 3. Okay. That's correct.
What happened to 1? Well, we just added another item.
We added 2.
One is the administrator definition, two is the budget calendar definition, three is the concurrent consult definition.
Okay.
Four is fact finding, and five is mediation, and six is the pizza.
Further discussion on the motion. First call roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Gansmore?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
McPherson? Aye.
Aye. Yours? John, do you really want to testify?
No, I think I have a note on there that I didn't. I would say one thing, that there's nothing in this bill that has not already been approved by the Senate.
By the Senate?
Everything that's in this bill still has already been approved by the Senate. They have a little more on there.
I would say it doesn't really explain anything.
Both of it.
Representative Howard moves amended Senate Bill 314 to the full committee of the due pass recommendation. Clerk, call roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye. Sorry. Is there anyone here to testify on Senate Bill 201? I guess we really don't have any other time. All right, let's go. Senate Bill 728. Brent English.
Gentlemen, my name is Brent English. I'm a student at Oregon State University. I'd like to read a prepared statement which I have this morning and ask any questions on Senate Bill 728. I'm a senior political science at Oregon State University, and in the first part of January 1971, a group of students at the University of Oregon and Oregon State and Portland State met in Portland to discuss current and proposed legislation coming up in this session. At that point, we learned of the University of Oregon's desire to introduce a bill to the State Health Affairs Committee, or some bill within the Oregon legislature, concerning putting a student or a group of students on the State Board of Higher Education. In the past 10 years, students, that's probably the most vociferous segment of contemporary society, have undergone a fundamental evolution in their perspective and understanding of American society. Since the early 1960s and the Civil Rights Movement in the South, to 1964 in Berkeley, California, and to the 1968, 69, and 70 anti-war protests on virtually every major college campus, students have learned what I feel is a painful lesson to learn, that the institutionalized change within a societal framework is agonizingly slow. As the problems in the overt state become increasingly obvious, the problems inherent in the rational process become more painstaking. Education is perhaps the best example of an institution undergoing increasing metamorphosis. Education is, in my opinion, the most paramount institution in this country. Without a solid basis for understanding the past, it is impossible to understand the future. Education has traditionally been billed as the franchise of the free country. By now, that billing is as old as the billboard and must be altered. The youth of America are facing the most incredible challenges this country has ever seen. It is not only plagued with providing and maintaining individual freedom, but now must begin to conjecture ways and means to reorient a society which is moved by sheer production, sheer profit motive, and has known only token social responsibility. This production ethic is in a large part the most important cause for the visible determination now besieging the planet Earth. We must orient our institutions toward a common goal. Government and education are integrally tied and must be examined in a mutual light. Students, after trying ostensibly every joker in the hand, are coming to the realization that what is needed is a new politics in this country, much different and much broader than what we presently see. The new politics are not a well-greased political machine such as Chicago, but rather an individual country sharing common goals about the quality of life in America as well as the rest of the world. One student on the State Board of Higher Education is a very needed perspective. It is difficult to explain student frustrations in a collegiate situation. It appears that by the time students reach college, he has already made fundamental decisions about many issues. The educational framework currently slaps a title on a bewildered being and sends him to a professor which holds a grade above his head, much like a carrot and a rabbit. Finally, after maturation is much more complete, the void in the quote education process becomes vivid and definable. I'm optimistic that education in this country will respond to the increased need for academic relevance in the overworked term. Through Senate Bill 728, providing one student on the State Board of Higher Education, this response could be expedited. In the words of John Kennedy, we have the power to make this the best generation in the history of mankind, or to make it the last. I feel that Senate Bill 728 is perhaps one of the most fundamental efforts by students and by the administrations on the college campuses to provide a working interrelation between students and the State Board of Higher Education, which is the administrative agency for the state of Oregon. It appears in the last 5 years, students have really begun to take a very fundamental look at the education process and understanding what the problems are and how to work with them. And it appears to me that perspective, the student perspective, is very much needed on the state board. And that after a long relationship with the governor's office, this bill being engrossed from the initial bill from the University of Oregon, I feel this thing is merits to pass. I'll answer any questions you have.
Questions for Mr. Anderson? Dan Dan.
In section one, you talk about succession. In other words, one non-voting student member succeeds to the other position. How do you guarantee that? I haven't had a chance to read the bill yet, but how do you guarantee that the governor does that?
Well, as we understand, the governor would appoint these two students, and that one student which would succeed to the position of governor would, I guess, under Bill of Trust, would hold that he would be in college at that time and still would qualify. That he must take 12, he must be in good standing at the university and take 12 credit hours.
What happens if he decides not to come back to school then?
Well, I imagine that kind of exhausting circumstance has to be taken by the governor. Probably what he would do is then again appoint someone like he was asking for the initial bill. But I doubt that would happen. I thought it could pop it off.
I have a concern about one student voting and two students sitting there trying to represent.
About 54,000.
We're never going to get anybody that's really representative.
Well, I don't think the position is definitely going to be a representative position, although in my testimony, what I tried to bring out is that students need to get their perspective. I think that's a conglomerate perspective to the State Board of Higher Education. In the last year, I've had a lot of dealings with the State Board, and over and over again, they ask students, well, what do you think about this? And various individual students come up, and usually it's a rather unified front. The Interinstitutional Union of Students, IUSHASHI, which I'm not sure if you're aware of, is supposedly this kind of a body to bring student concerns to the state board. And each of the student governments in the last couple of years have provided a legislative task force and also a state board of higher education liaison from their student governments to present ideas to the board of higher education. Our problem has been is that a voting member on the state board of higher education has been non-existent. And just by suggesting to the state board various ideas and various perspectives has not been overly powerful. Not powerful in the sense of wanting to take the State Board of Higher Education over, but just making our point known very clearly. And that has not been done at this point.
Well, the concern that a great number of people have is the governor really puts somebody on as an activist. The guy's going to first spend the whole time. I mean, I can think of an excellent example, most of us in the University of Oregon, being graduate, I guess I can bring them up, that people, if they have this position, would spend the entire year trying to disrupt the board because they couldn't have their way, and then the next shot is to trust them.
Well, I guess it comes down to the fundamental trust. In my opinion, I think that the governor could probably make a very, very very valid assessment of the individual candidate wanting to be on the board. Also, he's not bound to a student government appointee or a student government application. He can pick someone at large, and it would seem that he would take a long time in selecting someone to be on the board, which is competent. Same way that he selects someone on the state board at this point, and being approved by the Senate.
Among the 55,000 students, he could probably find two real passes that would just go right down the line for the board, the chancellor, or whoever else wanted to be yes man. And then a student, I would seem to me, would be more unhappy than they are right now.
Yeah, well, that possibility exists. I grant you that. What I would think is that I think that the governor himself will take a clear and cogent look at what this position should provide and why the entire bill has been presented. But we feel that we need a new perspective or an additional perspective on the state board. And I think the governor will select a student which is competent, which might go down the line sometimes, and other times might deviate from the existing established point of view. I think we have to
think about it. I don't think there's an established point of view on that state board right now.
Yeah, that's not the only thing there is.
Probably surprised. Now,
two more questions. First, what's the rationale for not giving them the one member voting rights?
Well, the rationale for that is continuity. The initial bill, which was presented, provided three students on the state board, all voting members. The governor's office came up with this revision or amendment or proposed version. And the idea is that the one student would serve there on the board as a non-voting member for an entire year and gain the workings of the process. And then for the next year, he would be a voting member for continuity of term.
Also, nothing as I read the existing law that prevents the governor from appointing
I don't know. I'm not that conversant on the law. I would probably have to read through it. I imagine.
It just says, in 351.020, the director shall be citizens of Oregon, shall be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate.
The office been able to appoint someone over 21 years old and students never joined any other stores appointed when he wanted, but they never appointed him.
Yeah, well, I think that's indicative of the feeling that the State Board of Higher Education ought to be a non-student body trying to administer higher education, and I think that's valid. The idea now is that if you give someone who is virtually a student and must be a student, you gain essentially a perspective from the student view, and I think that's important. And even if the student has just been through higher education and then goes out into the business world, he loses sight very fast of what higher education is. And higher education right now is in a dynamic flux. Students are thinking different thoughts, and they're trying to find new solutions to the new problems and the old existing problems.
Further questions? Other than essentially, what's the difference between the original bill and the improved bill?
Well,
then it doesn't mean.
Well, the original bill that you're talking about, I don't think was the original bill. It was another bill. I've got the original copy here of the bill, and it was just asking for 11 directors, one student voting and one non-voting.
Okay, maybe I'll make my
own. Another bill.
Clearer. Yes, I think it was another bill. It was providing, and it was killed very fast. And I, the bill didn't make it through the legislative process. Okay, but this bill here provides for the one student voting and one student non-voting. The initial idea was to provide as many students as possible on the board as voting. That has a lot of inherent problems, which I'm sure you understand, especially your problem, Representative Martin, about students really antagonizing the board and slowing down the process, which the board doesn't need one of.
1587.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's correct. Well, this is Senate Bill 728, but it's in Rose. So if there's been a change in the Senate, that's what I was wondering. What was the change?
I am not certain of the change. As far as I know, I have not studied this bill in depth. I have studied only the bill and worked with the thing that's the basic law. The change, I imagine, would be small. I'm not sure. It might be someone else who will testify with the note being broken.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any further questions?
Thank you. Ron Wilkinson.
I'm Ron Wilkinson. I'm student body president at Oregon State University, a junior in agriculture at Oregon State. I'd like to briefly comment on this bill from Oregon State's aspect and why the student government at Oregon State supported this bill. Brent's already commented on a lot of the points that I could get into, so I'll try to not repeat too much of what Brent has said. But basically, for a number of years, students have been seeking a more active and responsible role in decision-making processes throughout the entire university and throughout the government functions completely. And Senate Bill 728 simply provides for a major step in that direction. The State Board of Higher Education is basically the body that makes the policy decisions that directly affect students in all the state system schools. To have definite and real student input into that decision, it's very necessary to have a vote on a body. I think you're well aware of the difference between lobbying before a body, trying to get them to make a point across, and being an actual voting member of that body. And this basically is what this bill provides for, is putting a student voting member and a student non-voting member on the board. At OSU, we've made some definite steps in placing students on decision-making bodies in our university committees, on the president's cabinet of our university, and in every one of these cases, it's proved beneficial. Beneficial not only from the student standpoint, but beneficial from the faculty and administration standpoint. The decisions that are made affect the students, and it's important that you have the input of those students that you're affecting, those people that you're affecting, onto those bodies. And the people on the university committees have all indicated to me that they're very happy to have that student input in a voting capacity. One vote on the board certainly isn't going to change every decision of that board.
Might change some key ones, though.
If it does change those, I would simply say that perhaps it's changed in a direction that's more responsive to the people that it's affected. In recent years, students in the state system have been working, trying to coordinate our activities somewhat. Grant mentioned the Interinstitutional Union of Students. This is a union of all of the schools in the state system, representatives from those schools, working towards common problems of those bodies. And I think from that standpoint, it shows that the state system schools and students can work together towards the problems that are affecting the state system schools. All of the student governments in the state system have endorsed this bill, 728, and have endorsed the idea of having voting student representatives on the State Board of Higher Education. At OSU, I think some of the main reasons the bill was endorsed was basically, first, that student representatives on the board will give students a more direct contact with the board. The board decisions directly affect students, and I think because of that, there should be more direct contact with students. Secondly, the governor will make the appointments of the students, therefore the various universities through an election couldn't put somebody on the board that would not be willing to accept the responsibility and the accountability of the decisions that are made by the board. And as I mentioned before, thirdly, there's a major difference between being an onlooker lobbying and being an actual voting member of the board. I hope that these reasons, and I hope that the ideas of the schools of the state system will serve to encourage you to send this bill out of committee with due attention. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, I do, but before going further, let me tell the rest of the committee that the changes made between the original bill and the engrossed bill are on page 3. The first sentence, the original bill required only 8 credit hours. Each academic term, that's been increased to 12. And the language on lines 6 and 7 of page 3, which states how the governor is not limited in his selection of those persons recommended, was added from the old bill. Those are the only changes that I can pick out. You brought up this one vote is not going to be key. It brings up another interesting question. There are going to be 10 votes, 10 voting members of the board, which is on occasion in this legislature, but it's high. It's a little hard to break. Do you see any problem with that?
I really am not personally aware of the reasons it was changed to make it an even number. Definitely it can lead to some problems, as this legislature has made aware. I think that if it comes to a tie, that'll mean that the body has to further look into the problems that it's discussing, and perhaps it can work out a suitable arrangement. I'm really not sure what will be the decision in the case of a tie. I guess it takes a majority vote to pass something, and so if it doesn't receive a majority, it does not pass.
The thing ties people on several votes, but
I think that one of those votes would have been 6-4.
Where are you from?
I'm from Oregon State. I'm from Lebanon.
Lebanon? Mm-hmm. Yeah, calling the place?
Lebanon?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the part of Lebanon.
Taking agriculture.
Well, I wasn't sure. That's what I wanted to find out.
I was in the East Multnomah County.
Yeah.
Quick question. Representative Anderson, what is your contact with the state board now?
You as me,
and you as the student leader.
Presently, our contact with the board is basically through a lobbying capacity. We can, you know, just as we are with the legislature, basically, we can come to you and present our cases, and we can do the same with the state board.
You go to the meeting?
I've just been elected. I haven't attended. I've attended one meeting.
How about your predecessor?
My just recent predecessor was not, well, I won't say that. No, he did not attend. The year before that, the president did attend.
So would it still mention the normal function?
Yes, I would assume it is my normal function, or at least to have legitimate representatives of me at the meeting.
Does the state system invite you, or let's say your position, not you, ask your interest, ask for recommendations on things?
Yes, they have. Yes. Well, I might comment on that. They have to an extent. And
we're just wondering if they did it all.
Yes, they do to an extent.
We had testimony from Mr. Lehman, since I believe chairman of the Board of Higher Education, on a previous bill where we shortened the term to 4 years of the other members and limited them to 2 4-year terms. And his big pitch was it takes a long time to learn how to operate on the board, how the board operates. It takes maybe 2 or 3 years for some people to pick up what's going on. Do you feel that what happened with the student just being on for basically 2 years and voting only one of the 2 years?
True, there will be somewhat of a problem in the fact that a student on the board won't be aware of all the history or the workings of the board in the past. I would hope personally that the governor will appoint someone to the board that has shown an interest in the board before the time he's appointed, so that he is aware of some of the things that have been happening with the board. I hope the governor will certainly look at that as a prerequisite, because I think it's very essential that the student does know what's happening, at least to an extent.
Good question. Thank you very much, Ron.
Thank you.
Stephanie Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, hi, I'm Stephanie Martin, and I'm representing the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. And I'd briefly like to take a little bit of history of why we decided to introduce this bill and the procedure that was thus far being through. The bill you have before you, Senate Bill 728, I would like to emphasize, is supported and fully endorsed by the governor. This specific plan that you see before you has been researched by his staff for the past 3 years, so it's not in any short term, and if we did discuss it, we sit down overnight and figure it out. We did have his help and his support on it. Yes, originally there was another bill. It was House Bill 1587, and this bill was introduced by the ASUO in February. The rationale for our requesting that there be 3 students on the board was, number one, that students pay 25% of the operating costs, therefore they should have 25% of the representation, but that was 3 students at the time. But we ran into many, many difficulties concerning the mechanics of the bill, and many representatives and senators had objections which could not be satisfied by that plan. So we compromised and we endorsed and fully supported the governor's plan. And I would like to briefly draw your attention to line 23. There was a previous question about whether the governor could appoint a student and why he didn't. He was prohibited from doing so by state statute, which says that any director on the board must not be affiliated with any of the state institutions. This is why it does require a statutory change in order for the student to be appointed. Representative Martin outlined the changes made by the Senate Education Committee. I have one other comment, and that was your question about a tie vote, what would happen in the case. And I think Senator Roberts in the Senate Education Committee very well pointed out that in both the Senate and the House, you have 60 members and you have 30 members. In case of a tie vote, the bill does not pass. It would be the same as it fails. So there are ways to get around this kind of problem. I don't really need to see any problems with that. One other thing I would like to point out was that Representative Martin made a question about the quality of students that would be picked. And I think if you analyze the procedures by which a student would be picked, number one, that it would be recommended by all the state governments and all the state universities, and from these people, it is likely that the governor would select the student. Now, the quality of student, I think, is much more important than age, very much so. And again, I think I'd like to point out that students, as well as representatives and the people, are making a commitment of trust in the government to pick someone who will be representative of students. But we genuinely feel that if we get someone younger and who has been involved in the educational process and has had the unique experiences and has been one of the educational actions in the classroom, that he will surely be a benefit to the state board. Okay, I'd briefly like to outline what other states and some other countries are doing so that we can establish a precedent for establishing a student on the board of control. This information I'm going to quote to you has been received from the Associated Student Council for University Reorganization. Currently in the United States, 16 states have students participating on the boards of control at public institutions which are supported by taxes. And these states are in one, Pennsylvania, which all state universities have one student on the board of trustees, Colorado, one student on voting on the board of control, Massachusetts has one student on the board of higher education appointed by the governor, South Dakota, two voting student members, Idaho, one voting student elected by the students, Connecticut, three voting students elected by students, New Mexico, one non-voting student on the board, Vermont, eight non-voting student members, in Washington, D.C., one out of 11 board members are students, non-voting, in Kentucky, incidentally, was the first state to have student participation in their board of control, and they have one student on the 12-member board. Nevada, one student out of 13 members. Wyoming, one student out of 12 members, and the student body takes no vote. North Dakota, one student out of 11 board members on the State Board of Higher Education. Incidentally, this is one of the few states that do have a system similar to Oregon, where you have a general State Board of Higher Education for all state universities. Montana, one student on 20 board members, and that student body takes it with a vote. New York City University, one student out of 21 members, and Rhode Island, two voting members, which are selected from the Student Senate. Currently, legislation has been introduced in the state of Illinois and the state of Ohio for establishing a student on their board of control. I'd briefly like to quote from a book called Should Students Share the Power by Earl J. McGrath, who is the U.S. Commissioner on Education. And he can give you kind of an idea of what the Canadian universities are doing essentially. With few exceptions, the members of the Association of Canadian Universities and Colleges have brought students into the top policy-making bodies, which until very recently included only administrative officers, faculty members, and trustees or governors, as they are usually called. Most of the institutions which have not made such structural changes plan to do so, and some have only been delayed by the necessity of legally amending their founding act. Of the 30 institutions responding, which include virtually all the major universities, 10 have admitted students to the Board of Governors, and 4 others are considering doing so at an early reconstitution of these bodies. A few boards have permitted students to sit as observers without giving them legal membership. Even though several respondents declared that they had no intention of adding students either to the board or to the Senate, the course of general practice throughout Canada today would suggest that in time, the prevailing policy would become universal. So you have the precedent not only in 16 states in the nation and also in Canada, but I think you would take a close look upon the many private universities in the United States, such as Stanford, Antioch, and more closer to home, Lewis and Clark and Pacific University, which have students on their board of trustees. The legislature, by enabling the governor to appoint students to the State Board of Higher Education, will help destroy the feeling of alienation which has led to some discontent and some turmoil. The educational system will be better able to respond to students' concerns and better provide legitimate channels through which they can work. The State Board of Higher Education makes critical policy decisions determining financing, curriculum, building construction, and student activities. It is exceedingly difficult for a 9-member board composed of 4 lawyers to carry on law practices and 4 business executives with corporate responsibilities to receive enough information to make decisions which would be to the best interest of the people involved in the educational process. John Mosser, a state board member, in a speech made on the University of Oregon campus on November 10, 1970, pointed out that board members can never fully be aware of the day-to-day problems of the institution. Student members would provide the board with a direct access to the university environment so that the board decisions would more accurately meet the real needs of the campuses. The State Board of Education would then truly be such a talking discussion. We have what we consider to be also a very good economic argument for why students should be involved in this board. Since students pay tuition or pay taxes in from tuition and incidental fees and other fees at the university, then students pay 25% of the operating costs. Now, if we would have 25% of the reputation, that would be 3 students, but we're only asking for 1, which is in terms of token representation. But yet the symbolic impact of having a vote on such a body would be tremendous among the universities and motivating more students to get involved. Lastly, I would like to point out that the system of having one voting member and one non-voting member was that it satisfied many of the objections of people such as Representative Martin Butler, that how can a student be informed? How can you expect a young student to carry on the responsibilities of the board and take experience and knowledge and people who have corporate responsibilities or much more capable positions? I think I would like to point out that it's not necessarily a matter of age, but a matter of quality of choice and the type of person and the commitment he's willing to make to do the research. A student would not only be able to draw upon his own resources, but he would be able to draw upon the students at all the state universities, as far as using resources, turning and getting other students to find the training and get back from them. So, I'll answer any questions now.
Stephanie, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Anyone that further wishes to testify on Senate Bill 728? Thank you. We set this up for him. A whole bunch of bills. Can't get that tennis thing just by his bill.
Did we put the archives amendment in? Didn't we? We voted them in, didn't we?
Yes, adopted by committee on the 27th, yeah. But the bill got tied. Why it's on the lower. I don't know if they want to send it out or not.
I think it was the one Jack and I wanted to rewrite. Change the answer. Right? In other words, we wanted to make them inaccessible unless they were decided.
Yeah, did you come up with any amendments?
No, I haven't had time to work on it.
That's our
problem. I think this is better than, I think this is worse than if I rewrote it. Well, I don't, passing no bill at all would be better than passing this one.
Well, I talked to administrators and students, and they feel it's a crisis situation. It's totally without guidelines. They don't know what the situation is.
Well, this guideline, though, was
make it available to everyone?
Yeah, for sure.
He wants to be able to go in and get access to the records in case somebody becomes world famous and he wants to write a history.
We adopted it.
Why, if a guy got elected president or something, they'd want to go back and find out what the great average was. You know?
I
can't see anything too wrong in Canada. The bill, but I will. Well, I want to offer some amendments. Well, this is fine. We're getting awful close to the end of the deck here. At least they're telling us we are.
See, I have some amendments penciled in the end of here. They deleted only on line 10 and inserted on left instead of upon line 11.
and then on 13 would not suffer. What does that do? Would that change any intent?
Where's the suffer going?
Not suffer on line 13 between would and suffer. In other words, it would read, regulations adopted under subsection 1 of this section must require the personal records be subjected to restrictions on access unless a finding by the president of the institution or by the division or the department head of the public interest in maintaining individual rights to privacy and adequate educational environment would not suffer by disclosure of such personal records.
Well, it turns the whole bill.
That would do what I would.
That would make all records almost.
Well, it would be private unless found by the president and department head.
Yeah, but the part about not suffering. Say the guy's contract. You know, if the guy's just blatantly guilty of something, he would definitely suffer if the records were disclosed. Would that? Would anybody turn the record? What else?
What is it that the records is so so secretive?
Well, I'm thinking of, you know, like the FBI runs around now, and if you're going into the service, if you're going to federal government work, I know they can contact teachers, faculty members on recommendation. And let's say a guy, does something around the school, late out after hours, doesn't make closing hours, and maybe he's not very good at, he does it several times. Potentially could get in a guy's file that if they looked at him for federal employment, he might not take him for a silly thing like that.
Same thing, if you go downtown 40, you stay out 11 o'clock, they pick you up and go to the record. What are your students, how's the students so different than anybody else?
Well, of course, I think
we agree on that. If you're out after 11 o'clock, they pick you up and take you to the Jewel Isle home. It's not a criminal record, but it shows that you was out after hours.
I'm not sure I agree with that.
I don't see anything wrong with
would you buy, I have no objections at all for a part of unless there's a finding by shall be secret unless there's a finding by the president and the minister and so forth.
That's
minister.
My intent,
but I the other one about unless if it would not an individual would not suffer by disclosure. I think there are situations where he probably would suffer and perhaps it's in the public interest that they'd be disclosed.
Like might make a mistake a couple times before they did something. Yeah, that record. I mean, this is the principle of.
I think if you look, try to read the damn thing, see what it says. It says regulations must require that personal records be subjected to restrictions on access. That's a must. Personal records must be subject to restrictions on access. Must require that only on kindness of president. That probably gets to maintain in there the last part of the United States environment and stuff like that. So, what the hell is that?
I think that was last in high school than anybody else.
Yeah,
I don't care
the language. What does the original language mean? Well, this means that they're accessible. They are accessible.
Right.
They're not accessible. They're accessible under the original language. If you have to restrictions on access only upon driving of the president or the department.
Yeah.
If he doesn't make that finding, then they're accessible with their familiar card. Yeah.
I'll try it on the side.
So you might have a head of a department in one institution making the determination that they are acceptable in one and then part of the basis would be the exact opposite. Well, there might not be any uniformity. They leave the decision to the department. That could go either way I've written it or later. That could happen either.
That's good. All right.
So what about this?
You want to think about it more? I don't want a bill for it. I'm talking about this one.
I don't know the way it's written. I think not.
Move before the Senate Bill Committee with the DPAS
recommendation. Representative Howard moves Senate Bill 7-3 to the full committee of the DPAS recommendation. Clerk call roll.
Anderson? Yes, Mark?
No.
Howard?
Aye.
McPherson?
No.
We got five
on the committee, so I guess.
Oh, try.
All right, Senate Bill 131. What?
Here.
Do you have an amendment behind your book? I'll pass these out, but give them back so they go into them. This is the amendment that Senator Tia talked about that.
Lowered
to 5 a.m. rather than 5. Is that?
Page 3.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's too low.
What's the other stuff do?
20
those
days. John, do you know what these amendments do?
Yeah,
yes. I know. I think the basic thing for families is cost. We have application only to the district president under tenure law, so it makes no change in reference to where the cost goes. But it does throw the burden to the district board. You got anything else in there? I'm not familiar with
it. It just says if you go to all these panels and these review committees, that the board pays the cost.
The board pays the cost. Actually, this would be lesser than what it's before.
Well, the first part of it is that, are you sure this is the section that's handled? Is this actually lowering it to 45, to 5,000? It's over here on page 2, section 3, subsection 2 is the area I'm talking about, all school districts.
Representative Martin, I recall these, specifically what he's done here is he's reacted to the statement that there may be some question as to whether the bill would work adequately in those districts that do not have a full-time administrator, which he's assessed here at 580 AM, so it extends then effectively July 1, 1973, to those with between 4,500 and 500. During the first biennium, it would operate only in those over 4,500, and it assesses the compensation on four of those people that were members of the Ferris Mental Review Board, who are appointed by the governor last 5 months.
Section 5 then does deal with what districts are covered by tenure?
No, that's the part dealing with the evaluation portion of my.
Well, what districts now evaluate?
None. Mandatory. Some do, but I can say in the cases that I've worked on non-tenure districts, and even in some tenure districts, I would say that better than half that I've ever looked at records have no records. And in tenure districts, some by policy only evaluate every 3 years. So this would be a change in that, like an annual evaluation mandatory.
No, this does not meet the. This does not lower the ADM to 500. And
no, it does not. So simply for the purpose of evaluation.
Simply for evaluation.
I never did think that.
I move the amendment.
Well,
I want to make clear what the 500 does.
So, well, 500 just for evaluation purposes. So if we want to lower it to 800 ADM under the entire provision, that's a separate question. As you quite correctly pointed out in the
paper,
so we can adopt these, but we still
have it. Representative Howard moves that the amendments to engross Senate Bill 131 dated May 25th be adopted. Further discussion? Let's call the roll.
Anderson?
Yes, Lord?
Aye. Howard?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
Thor?
Chairman, I'd like to propose an additional amendment that the ADM for the entire bill be placed at 800 instead of going all the way. Now, John, do you have amendments?
I don't have any, but I can guess it for you within the hour.
All right, now we're talking about pension opinion. The bill is now written. That requires that all districts in the state be covered. You are two. The bill as presently written covers all school districts. The present law, tenure only covers school districts of 4,500 or more. Representative Densmore is moving we lower that to 800 instead of the bill that is all the way. I have some real questions and concerns. I am going to have to support something higher than 800. But So yeah, Representative Denton will move that in section 3, subsection 2, the language be changed to extending that coverage by this bill to districts of 800 or more students.
Well, before we vote on that, you said you'd ask me for something higher. What amount?
As far as I'm concerned, I'm trying to find some better ground. The present law was 4,500. Every school district in Lyons County under 4,500 written in this bill.
If I could speak to 800, I think 800 is a good compromise between the present level and all the way. I think it's, as it was brought out in the testimony, it's hard to justify procedures of this bill, which I think is a good, healthy bill, that teachers be evaluated every year and that they that procedures be outlined that make it easier for a board to dismiss a teacher for incompetence without having to resort to the courts and that sort of cost thing. I think it's a good compromise.
Why do we need a compromise? Why? What's the difference in having a teacher that 250 students having the protection of the law, or somebody that happens to teach over 800? It's exactly the same person we're bringing down from 4,500. You need more in the school.
Consideration.
I don't know how many students you have, or have any idea. But I can't see why the teachers out there have not been protected.
The point is, they're not protected now.
Why shouldn't we protect them? We're going to go down and protect above 800. Why go away? If you want to get rid of the teachers, you may want to get rid of her.
The point is, now they can get rid of her arbitrarily. Yeah. My feeling is a practical consideration that more members of the House could accept them.
Not
now covered
that. I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't
think so. And then if the law works, we can extend it. What do they have?
If the law works, we can extend it next time.
What do they have? They just take 145 items. Don't take me out. No parents listen to you. Nothing. So what you're going to do is do everything you can extend the parents' gift.
Okay.
The bill is good now. It goes up like that. That's true. I'd vote for it, but I'm
not trying to help you. Let's vote on Representative Danforth's amendment. It's an extension of tenure or extension of the effect of the bill to school districts of 800 students or more. First call roll.
Edison. Danforth.
Aye.
Howard.
Nope.
McPherson.
No.
Martin.
No.
We'll wait until Andy can get here on this one. Well,
Mr. Chairman, if Representative Howard's objection is we don't go all the way, then I move that we send it out as amended right now.
All right, Representative Denton moves and Gross but amended with that.
I wonder what we're doing. I can put them on. Extend fair dismissal to all teachers as of 1973. Now it's 4,500. What about tenure? Well, tenure is rewritten completely in 1931.
But in effect, we changed the name.
We've also changed the fact that there's no evaluation. Now there's an annual evaluation. We've also changed the fact that a teacher has recourse to the court to the procedure by which he does not. The final appeal in this situation is the final appeal. And we've also shortened the procedure considerably. Within a specified amount of time, the action is taken. And I believe it could extend even at a maximum only a couple of 3 days beyond the end of the school year. So I think it's fair to all parties.
So,
what do you think?
The amendments that we adopted don't do it. They don't extend anymore. Well, that's what we're voting on right now. We want to lower, we've already voted not to lower 800. The motion now would be to send it out covering all school districts, including those not now covered under 4,500. That's what the bill does, again. But it also changes the procedures and so forth. There's a list of school districts that come curious about the problem.
It extends it to the, it changes this for those who already have it now, and then adds up 73 would extend it to
there are 50% on unfortunately.
Everyone's considered a probationary keeping aspect. Which means the board can dismiss on the one time for any reason without having to get caught.
Well, let's hold this to our next work session. For one thing, I want to find out, here are some more amendments, but I don't even know if they do. Got Mary Reese's name on it.
Well, those could have been the same ones we
know. These are different than the ones we just adopted. Well, drilling contractor.
I move we table 656.
Then Densmore moves that Senate Bill 656 be tabled. The clerk call the roll.
Anderson? Densmore?
Aye.
Howard?
No.
McPherson?
Aye.
Martin?
No. Two hang up on that.
I'm just the guy to offer my services, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for that.
What way are you going to vote, you know?
I don't know.
Senate Bill 560 is the bill that requires engineering for water district projects and a review by the State Board of Health. You, I believe, have a 560. I believe you have a bill. I got a whole bunch of things to ask about that. You have a bill in judiciary or a past bill that requires certain things under the engineering
Senate Bill 44.
Has that passed?
Yeah.
The objection that was voiced by one individual from Curry County was that this would require a engineering analysis and plans to go for every little tiny extension. That evidently is not so under Senate Bill 44.
It requires every county engineer to be a certified engineer.
Okay.
He's not on the phone now.
He's going to take
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'll move Senate Bill 560 to the full committee to do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk call the roll.
Anderson?
Gensmore?
No.
Howard?
What's this on?
I have 60.
Now, this is the one that Michelle from Gold Beach.
Laverne, this is the one that Laverne Miller testified in favor of, and Mr. Banker from Brooklyn testified against.
Hi.
Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill
396
to the full committee.
396.
Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
The bill was voted down in the House once.
Question.
Clerk call roll.
Anderson?
Gamble?
No.
Harris?
Hi.
McDermott?
Hi.
Martin?
No.
The people of the current, you're the one that says the bill's been killed somewhere that you shouldn't bring to resurrection.
Well, that's just on some bill.
That's your bill. That's subject matter in it.
That's just on bill right away.
I'm going to pass that as a 658 book. The
booklet. All right, are we ready for that?
Well, I don't know if we're ready for anything without Hannon's in here. Representative McPherson moves Senate Bill 658 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. This is the IED. Limitation bill. 6% limitation on
the Mr. Chairman,
could
I
go ahead.
Move to amend Senate Bill 658 to incorporate what I think is some necessary changes in the election of IEDC bill I have. That's in education had one of the hearings that I never heard of.
Why just small on the county? This advantage shall be provided each in a population of 300,000 or less.
Is that less or lower than
one? Yes. The district boundary shall divide each intermediate education district in a population of 2,000 or less, according to the list, into five zones. Single member districts for sub-districts. Single member sub-districts for under new board members.
You're
all right. All right. Representative. Representative Densmore moves that the language of House Bill 1110 be amended to Senate Bill 658. This would divide IEDs into five sub-districts for
already election. Known now. This just says instead of the school countries that you use as a census.
They're already in zone?
They're already in zone.
Not by population.
No, they're not by population.
Yeah. Well, but you don't vote on them. You vote on them at large.
Right.
What's this
do
now?
Go ahead,
once more.
It's
zone.
Well,
electoral
population.
Board of directors. Yeah, equal population for the board of directors. By the law of
Oklahoma
County.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Doesn't affect all those.
It does not affect every other county but Mahoning. And it exempts the county from 300,000 or more. All right, let's vote on the amendment. Clerk, call the roll.
Anderson?
Aye. Howard?
No.
McPherson?
No.
Martin?
I'll vote aye.
Martin votes aye.
It's
ordered now.
Where does it go? Where does the
amendment? Hand me that letter
down. You have to revise the title.
You didn't have to have legislative counsel. Representative McPherson moves amended and grows Senate Bill 658 to the full committee of the due pass recommendation. Clerk, call roll.
Anderson?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
Good
bill.
You don't have a last amendment.
Aye.
Aye.
Oh, wait a minute. Are you sure?
What?
Well, if you haven't lost the bill up to that last amendment, we don't even know what it is yet.
Just decide you didn't know the legal population.
Order. We're going to hear
heard about seven bills this morning. Betty, why don't we start with Senate Bill 308?
Well, I'm still all
committee
members, but I say.
Oh, yeah. I can't, I don't know where they are. They may not show up for this 1 minute.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, there may be some other people arriving to testify at a later time. Senate Bill 308 is a bill that would prohibit discrimination in public accommodations on the basis of sex. This is has been called to my attention by some incidents that have occurred in some places in Portland that are places of public accommodations. I was asked to introduce the bill for a group of young ladies who have been discriminated against in these places of public accommodations, and I think that this is simply filling a gap in some of our civil rights legislation. What I want to say to you, Mr. Chairman, that I do want you to pass on the other members of the committee is this, and I'm very serious about that. I know that this is the kind of legislation that one can very readily make jokes about and be humorous about, but for those persons who have been discriminated against, it is not a laughing matter. I remember last session when we were working on the bill on the prohibition of employment on the basis of sex, and I appeared before various committees of this legislature, and invariably the silly questions were asked over and over, and I think not out of the courtesy of part of the members of the committee, but it was kind of their way of trying to get some answers that they were confused about, because discrimination on the basis of sex is new in many of these areas, and sometimes it's a sensitive matter. For example, last year when we were talking about employment business, one farmer made the comment, well, does this mean I'm going to have to hire women in the hay fields now? And the answer was, if the woman can qualify to do the hay, and the answer is yes. And he said, well, I'll never get my hay again. With this, there was a great chuckle in the audience and among the members. Of course, the obvious answer to that is that our grandmothers and some of our mothers worked in the hay field, and it has never been unusual in this agricultural society for women to work in the field. And so I was kind of surprised at that kind of a comment. Another silly comment last session was, if we let women have equal employment opportunities and we can't discriminate on the basis of sex, does this mean we're going to have male go-go dancers? And my answer was, if the customer wants male go-go dancers, I presume that the owner of the place where go-go dancing is allowed would provide it. But that was not certainly a subject.
I don't know if it's personal experience, but I've been told there is
a place in Portland. And it may very well be. But my point is, the reason I give these two examples is that the silly question that's come up with this bill is, does this mean that now they will have to remove the signs over the ladies and men's restrooms? And that you can go hand in hand with your date to the restroom, or your wife, or somebody else's wife, or something other, and there won't be any separation in the restroom facilities. And my answer to that is two rationales, and I think both equally acceptable. One is that a restroom is not a public accommodation. It is a service that is provided within the public accommodation. It is not the public accommodation itself. I think that the management can provide any kind of restroom facility that he wants to. He may, and there certainly are many public places that provide only one restroom where both men and women go, this is not uncommon. Certainly in many places of employment, this is the case. They don't have restrooms separately. So if that is a choice that is up to the management to decide what he's going to do. But certainly I would say that if he chooses to maintain separate restrooms, that this he would not be placed in jeopardy under this bill because of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution allowing equal protection of the laws. The court has said that there can be reasonable classifications of individuals, and this to me seems to be a very reasonable classification under our mores and our type of habits that we have developed in our society. The other argument against this is that under the 19th Amendment of the Constitution, we all have a right to privacy, and certainly this is one of the most important rights we have to privacy, and that is over certain functions of our body, and that no one should feel that if this law passes, that their rights are going to be invaded by having males going into the women's restroom or women going into the male's restroom. It's just a silly question, but it's been asked over and over and over in the Senate. And I would hope the members of your committee, who are not present today,
I will not bring this up, but I'll accept you anything. Because I want to walk in here and see this bill, and that's exactly what they're going to say. So I hope you'll have the answer ready for me.
The only two questions I have, I assume that any place of public accommodation would not include a club such as the Arlington Club.
And Mr. Chairman, unfortunately, it does not include the city club. But it does, where these have occurred, and if these people are going to be present today, and I don't see them yet, but who have had the experience at Perkins Club, particularly in Litman Wolf, Perkins Club in Litman Wolf in Portland. Is a lunch, I don't know if it's dinner or not, but it's primarily, it's an all-male lunch restaurant. And they advertise it as a quick place for businessmen to have lunch. Some of the business women who have gone there with business associates have been refused service. They, however, let women come in on Saturdays because men are not working on Saturdays and they need the money. They need the business. So women can go on Saturdays, but they can't go on Saturdays.
There's a bar somewhere in downtown Portland. May or may not have been to the men's bar.
There's one in the White Hotel that is exclusively men's only. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what other places there might be. I don't know what other places. There are a number of places.
Oh, I know. Any further questions?
I just conclude that this is another step in what the women think we can eradicate not only through law but out of our thoughts.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, they're here now.
Testimony on Senate Bill 308. Go ahead. Come on.
First, it's extremely frustrating to have to spend time, money, and energy. Go to the law enforcement to get a bill, process, committee, schedule for a hearing, test time, etc. But the hope for end result, a law, which restates a right given us, but passes the 14th Amendment, which in part reads, no state can deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of its law. The other feeling is one of doubt as to whether the issue of sex discrimination in public accommodation here in Oregon. It's worth the time involved, considering all the larger issues of women's rights. But on further consideration, I came to the conclusion that it is well worth the attention, as really a perfect example of the whole problem of unequal treatment of women being condemned by the state. Labels were originally put on groups of people to serve a purpose in identifying certain characteristics that group had in common. For example, birthplace, color, religion, and sex. In the case of sex, the differentiating characteristics was the potentiality of the child there. Society has allowed the connotations these labels devote to gain greater dignity, often implying intrinsic degrees of living, and laws are reflected in cultural classification. However, members of all groups, accepting the white and oppression class of male, are reaching an awareness of the insidiousness of false private classification. Blacks will no longer tolerate being thought of as Jews as second class citizens. Indians are at last taking back some of what was right through there. And women will no longer tolerate laws which reinforce the false assumption of male supremacy. Even though the 14th Amendment was added to the United States Constitution in 1868, our culture has been plagued with the prevalent feeling that some people are more equal than others. However, the patterns of culture are changing, and our laws are reflecting changes. We, like the blacks and Indians, are examining what is right and wrong. We challenge anyone to justify the legality of discrimination against over 51% of the population because of one physical characteristic. This is an important deal. With the exclusion of the word sex, the definition of discrimination in the Civil Rights Code, Oregon state law is condoning the same kind of discriminatory conduct that the left of Madison has accepted.
They wrote that 14th Constitution back there. Do you think they ever thought the women would be wanting to go in and face the same way?
I don't think they thought of all around the state, but I think their intent was exactly our intent. All people should be treated as people under the Constitution.
They certainly didn't do it back in those days. If they had the intent, why didn't somebody do it? Or the women never even thought of it.
Well, as
you're grabbing it at straws and...
You know, I blacks also are treated that way. I mean, laws are a reflection of our cultural mores.
How much longer are
laws?
I just wonder, one of these buildings, are we going to, want women on one door and a man on the other one?
Well, we're one of the last countries in the world to do it that way, too.
Carl Woodward.
My name is Claire Woodward, and I'm here today representing the National Organization for Women as a member of the Executive Board of the Courts of the Chapter. Now representing over 10,000 women and men nationally, urges this committee to expedite the passage of Senate Bill 308, which expands the prohibition of discrimination in places of public accommodation to include sex discrimination. On April 7, 1971, Don Beck, a male member of NOW, called the reservation desk of Perkins Hut, a men's only eating establishment on the premises of Lippman Wolf and Company, Portland, and made luncheon reservations for 10 persons on April 12, 1971. On April 12, Don Beck and a male friend arrived at Perkins Hut and ordered sandwiches and coffee for 10 people. Two coffees and six sandwiches were served. At this point, the remainder of the party, all women, arrived. Perkins Pub refused to fill the remaining orders on the basis that the food would be served to and eaten by the women in the group. Requests for further service with the exception of coffee refills for the men's orders were refused. We slept quietly and in no way disturbed other patrons. However, we refused service. After waiting approximately 45 minutes, during which time a number of male patrons were served, we were left with no choice but to leave the restaurant. Now believes that to continue by the absence of laws and banks and closing public accommodations to one half of the public accomplishes an unreal and unhealthy practice by public sanction. This is just one more way that society tells girls and boys, men and women, that the freedom of movement and public activities of females can and should be regulated by others because we are females, who always have been and always will be secondary to men, and that men always have been and always will receive preference in public accommodations or elsewhere, because they have the economic, political, and other costs to buy advantage. The notion of male supremacy rises in repugnant as white supremacy, black supremacy, or female supremacy. Women are people. Are there any questions?
Questions? Thank you very much. Any further testimony on Senate Bill 308? Senate Bill 668, Senator DeMint.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Sam DeMint, State Senator from Susan Perry County, testifying on behalf of 668, which does basically four things and makes four changes in the present law. First, it would change the qualification for qualifying under farm use assessment from having made $500 gross income to $750. The next change would be to delete the exclusion of other buildings in determining farm use value. Third, it would require the assessor to use a weighted average of each class of land within the county when he's determining its rental values or farm use value. Fourth, it would require the tax court to finally determine the disagreement between the county assessor and the board of review if there is any. Now, reviewing each one of those, we've raised the qualification amount from $5 to $7.50. I think we have another bill in this committee, Senate Bill 275, that raises it to $1,500. Now, we recognize the fact that 500 is perhaps too low for to be realistically classified as a farm. But I would question the 1500 amount on the 275 because of many retired people on farms that are trying to maintain their farm, hold it, and still classify their home. For this reason, we have raised it to 750. Now, the other building exclusion, what is happening now in many cases, the fact of law now stands is that farm use values apply only to the land, not to the building. We recognize that homes can be assessed individually should be as farm use value. Here's what is happening in other buildings. For instance, a former dairy farm that has milking sheds, milking cars. Billings Hughes has a part of the dairy farm. Now, if that farm is not being used for a dairy ranch anymore, it's being used for grazing purposes or something else, many assessors are still assessing the Billings as their highest and best use value as a dairy type operation. They're no longer being used as that. The rent's being paid for the Billings and committed to storage or feeding. So we think that the Billings should be set at the use of the farm as present. The other change requiring the assessor to take into account each land class within the county. Many assessors are using a very small percentage of the total land classes in determining their rental value, which is, in the end will come up with the farm use value. For example, in our county, most of the rental studies are being made on bottom land dairy type operations. Right now, the dairy farmer is in a little better economic status than the hillland grazing farmer. When he takes only the bottom land rental, he reflects a higher value for the hillland. You get what I mean? So this would require him to take a weighted average of all classes of land that he can get information on. This would come up with a true picture of the income approach. And on the fourth reason here, many times the Board of Review will be in disagreement with what the assessor finally determines as the farm use value. All the present law states that the Board of Review will be in the advisory capacity, nothing else. This will give the Board of Review a little more power to, if they are in disagreement, they can ask the state tax court to settle their disagreement. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Questions for Senator DeMint?
What's the change in latitude? 750?
750 to 500. Present law is 500 gross income.
Well, let's stop some of the uses.
Go ahead,
Will. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Now, we're going to use the farm approach. If the dairy barns are just used to graze and don't use the barns, then they would be.
Well, under the present law, they exclude all buildings. They don't use buildings as consideration for farm use value. Mm-hmm. By including the buildings being used on the farm as the use they're being used at.
Use that
rather than what their highest and best use might be. Now, commercial appraisers, they take into consideration what the building's being used for. But here, the investors will say, well, this is a high priced milking shed, not being used yet, but they'll still put the same assessment on it as if it were being used as a dairy.
That's John Langlois. I
don't know if it's Tokyo or Nintendo.
Harakuji.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Howard Fuji with the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to endorse the statement made by Senator DeMint, and would like to mention to you that this is a statewide problem, and there are very few counties in which we don't have one or several of the problems that Senator DeMint mentioned. We believe it's essential that to get a true farm use appraised value in many of these counties to make some adjustments according to the income approach for agriculture farm use assessment.
Questions for the solution? Mr. Howard, suppose I have a particular assessment that I don't use for a whole year. Should I take that on that?
Well, equipment is not that personal property and would not be affected by
this. Well, so it's not about the same thing. It's talking about being taxed for something that you're not using at the present time or for that particular purpose.
So, well,
what about items that in other categories that are not being used for a particular period of time, yet they still have to be there?
Well, this is a problem in most counties. Some assessors have taken this into consideration to a degree, but generally they've been assessed. They're being appraised according to the book, so to speak, on personal property, and it is a problem.
Thank you. Further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very much. Any further testimony on 668? Senate Bill 728. George Lehman.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here this morning as an individual member of the Board of Higher Education, not speaking for the board, because as is the case in all such bills, the board takes no position on matters which are solely within the legislative purview, as the makeup of the board is. However, this bill to add a student to the board is of some concern to several of us as individual members, and I merely want to give you briefly two or three points that I hope you will consider. First, I want to say there is no question before the legislature as to student involvement. Students are now involved and will continue to be involved in the educational process. That is not the issue. The only issue is whether or not that involvement should include membership on a governing board of 9 people. The students now take part at every level of the institution, on up through the board meetings. They are represented at all board meetings. They are heard whenever they wish to hear, be heard. No doors are closed. Members individually and in meetings always willing to consider them, and I'm sure they do not feel that these doors have been shut. They have an interinstitutional representative at all board meetings, as the faculty do, and the institutions are represented at all board meetings. So it's not a question of them taking part in committees or in consultations or in the whole educational process. It's just one question, whether they sit on the governing board of 9 people. Now, in recent years, this has been a national question, and in a number of institutions, they have been added to boards. However, most of these, many of them are private schools with large boards. Most private schools have boards of 20, 30, 40 people, meeting rather irregularly, and they do not have the same governing function as this type of a board in a state system. And also, most of these cases, many of them are there on the board as a non-voting member. I do not know, there may be some, but I do not know of any system analogous to ours in which a student is now a voting member. There could be some, but most of they are not. But the several things I want you to consider in thinking of this rather new approach to the governing board in Oregon is the conflict of interest question, which I think is very real. In state administration, we generally try to avoid conflicts, not create them. And here there would be a direct conflict for the student who sat on the board, both in his relationship with other students and with the faculty and the administration. Now, it's true that parents might have an interest, or taxpayers might have an interest, and this has been argued that this measure has gone through the process. But there's no interest by anyone who would be as direct as a student in the institution, simultaneously being on the governing board, and at the same time dealing with teachers, department heads, deans, and school administration on grades and all other factors of his attendance, and simultaneously being, in a sense, superior to the president. It seems to me it would put the student in a most impossible position himself, one that would be awkward at every level, and we should try to avoid such a conflict. The law setting up this board tried to avoid this conflict, originally provided no one connected with an institution should be on the board. No faculty member, for instance, no classified employee, and that would still stand, but you have a student with a very direct interest, passing on budgets, hiring, firing, and all the other matters relating to the institution. Seems to me this is not desirable. But even more so, I want you would like to suggest to you the effect on the makeup of the board itself. Our board is a lay board, not representing faculty, students, alumni, labor, industry. A lay board representing the public. And once you inject the matter of a constituent interest, you will inevitably change the board. People will be on there representing a constituency, not the public generally. And inevitably, if you add a student in constituent capacity, you are going to have a demand by faculty, by administration, by alumni, by labor, and by industry to be on the board representing those areas. Certainly faculty would want to be on. Administration may want to be on. And there you'd have an even greater conflict, a man hired by the board sitting on the board to determine his salary. We had a bill this session to put the chancellor on the board, which would involve the same kind of conflict. And there's another function of the board which is not generally realized. Our board has a semi-judicial function. We sit occasionally hearing appeals from both students and faculty as it goes up through the process. You will recall that in the disturbances last year, and since then, our board has acted to strengthen the conduct code for both faculty and students. We have strengthened the procedures, we've tightened up loopholes, we have provided a fair due process. At the same time, we have kept ourselves from being helpless in situations where action needed to be taken. Well, when we hear an appeal that goes up through the various committees and courts and presidents to the board, we are the court of last resort before you go into the court system. If you have on our board a student, but not a faculty member, what's the faculty member who has the faculty appeal coming up to us going to say, I'm being judged by a lay board and a student, but no one of my peers? The student who comes up will have a student on the board, and he may be satisfied. But you will not, I would predict, be able to resist from a matter of just fairness. If you add a student to the board, which is a semi-judicial body, adding a faculty member and a president, so that they also are sitting in this appellate procedure. And I doubt if this has really been thought of at a number of levels, but most people think of us as a governing or administrative board, and not in this appellate function, which we exercise not every day, but every year. Our board should have people of diverse background. No one would argue that you shouldn't have young people. Perhaps there are too many people on our board who have been a generation or more than a generation out of college. There's no one saying you shouldn't have people in their 20s, or you shouldn't have recent graduates. The governor can do that under the present law, but he is limited from not appointing people connected with an institution. This would not involve any of the problems you have when you put someone in the direct institutional involvement on the board to be judging the matters of which he's taking a part. But last but not least, if you do feel that you want to add a student to the board, may I urge that you not leave us with a board of 10 voting members. There is no other board or commission in Oregon, and I don't know of any elsewhere.
The House and the Senate.
Yes, I know, and this came up in the Senate hearing, Mr. Chairman Martin, and my answer was that the Senate and the House are not administrative or governing bodies. They're not advisory bodies, as some boards are. Ours is the governing board. And also, there have been many constitutional questions raised whether the House and Senate shouldn't have an arm or not, but at least they're not administrative bodies. But in a governing board, having to reach decisions, you could be signing 5-5. There's no other board in Oregon, even advisory, that I know of, with an equal number. So if you feel that you want to do this and the decision is yours, please give very careful consideration that we do tie more often than we'd like to. It's inevitable with people of different backgrounds. We don't want a 10 rubber stamps or 9 rubber stamps. We often vote 5-4. We voted 4-4 on Oxford, and I had to cast a deciding vote. I haven't finished hearing about it from both sides. But nevertheless, there was a way to resolve it. It had to be decided. But this would be exceedingly awkward to have an equal number. And even Judge Davis, when he presented this to the Senate Committee, before I spoke, mentioned this point himself, that this is a question that perhaps should have further thought. And then I also mentioned this could be resolved in a number of ways, of course, by adding one more member of some kind or make non-voting members. But 10 voting members, please let me assure you, could involve real problems in deciding administrative problems when we have to be decided every month. Maybe not more than once or twice a year, but it does involve a built-in signing situation that I hope you will give consideration to. So those are the only points I want to make. I say to the Senate Committee, and I say again, I think the students who have pushed this matter are to be commended. They've done it in a very good way. I didn't hear a presentation here if they made one. I did hear the Senate presentation. They did a lot of research. They're operating within the system. They're entitled to be heard. We have no animosity toward them as such. But I think that these points that I've mentioned do deserve consideration in this final thing, and that we should not hasten to change either the type of board that we have, or above all, leaders of the board that they have a building. Thank you.
We heard this bill yesterday, and the students did give a very excellent presentation. Just to be the devil's advocate for a minute, two things I'd be concerned about. One, you bring up the sitting at the judicial body judging faculty members, and I can't think of someone I'd more rather have there judging the faculty members than the students.
Might be all right.
I served on a task force on higher education 2 years ago, and probably the greatest critics of some of the faculty, and usually the most unresponsive members of the faculty, are the students. We found that the 5 members of our task force and the students agree far more often than some of the upper echelon faculty members who spend most of their time knitting or writing books or doing something other than teaching. And I'm not so sure I wouldn't want a student to judging them. It might keep them on the track more.
Well, I can see your point, and we've had some, I don't mind saying, we've had some faculty problems in the CKS, yes. But nevertheless, whether you'd have a student judging, whether it wouldn't also be necessary to choose a faculty member, that's the next step.
I'll be the first one to just ever along a faculty member serving, or a faculty member at least, on the State Board of Higher Education. The other thing I'm concerned about, or I'm not concerned about, you bring this up, my concern would be that the suit would reflect the views of the institution as a rubber stamp, more than to stand back and be critical of it, that he would mouth only what the administrator or the chancellor wanted. And I would be more concerned, except I think that's been the case with a lot of members of your board, present company excepted, who've been nothing but a rubber stamp for the chancellor, or for the president of one of the institutions.
Well, I wouldn't want it to be backwards, but I'm sure you'll find in the last 2 years that it's not been the case. We've had many studies. And they're increased because there are more faculty members who have been appealing and more students too. So it's increased. But when you sit in one of these cases, you have a real problem. And then it goes to court. We have one now that's gone from us to the court. and there's a whole question of how we have education. It's not the daily thing, but it's certainly several times a year.
One more question, George, because I'm a teacher, then should I not pass on things that that's in secondary education?
No, that's a different type of thing. A teacher would debate whether, not as a teacher, but whether it's a public employee, but that's, of course, a different kind of thing, because you're not admitting.
Because this is an issue that has become a tremendously emotional one all over the country, and a symbolic one, that I wish it were possible to divorce it from those issues and to look at kind of the realities. And it seems to me that for a good many years, a lot of board members have been asking the question, what really is the role of a board of trustees or a board of regents? And thinking keeps finding its way back into articles and books and speeches, and I belong, for example, as our members of our board do, and I attend a little more often because I'm a vice president of it, the meeting of the Association of Governing Boards, where these things keep being discussed. And in the 9 years that I have been a member of the board, I have watched the matter of student participation in the decision-making processes in the institution change and change dramatically. Students say they are powerless, and yet when you look at the fact that they sit where the real power in an institution is, and that's at the departmental level, and at the school level, and at the institutional level, one recognizes the fact that they certainly are not powerless. And I think it's rather difficult for lay people who really would like an answer to the question, who's in charge, to look at the diffusion of the decision-making process within an institution and realize that nobody sits at the top and by fiat or decision says this is the way it's going to be. But the thing starts down at the departmental level. And it works its way up through the department, to the school, to the dean of faculty, to the dean of administration, to the president, to the chancellor's office, to the board, and eventually, of course, the legislature makes a great many of the decisions. But students presently sit on all of the important committees inside the department, inside the school, inside the institution. There's just one nationally that I think they have not been sitting on directly, and that's the one that deals with promotion and tenure and salary. And one of the reasons for that is that the matter of the confidentiality of the matters that are being discussed. But all over the country, students have been evolving systems of evaluation of teaching. And I think that one of the real concerns of everybody is the quality of particularly undergraduate teaching in the institution. In the Oregon system, students sit on the search committee for presidents, they sit on search committees for deans, they participate in the appointment or the election of departmental heads. The board has adopted policies that outline very clearly the students' participation in the governance of institutions in a paper adopted in 1968. Spelled out very clearly that students do have a great deal to contribute. They should be heard, and they are heard. As Mr. Lehman said, they appear before board committees, they appear before board meetings. They have an inter-institutional union of students, which got started a couple of years ago, and this is composed of representatives from the different institutions in the state system. I should say one thing about their participation in committees. I see very often in the Emerald and in the Barometer particularly, articles asking for students to come and serve on committees, that there are 27 openings on 13 committees, for example. And I think it has been the experience in some institutions that when it gets down to the pretty heavy going and the nitty-gritty work of committees that go on and on and on, that sometimes the student participation drops off. But in our institution and our system, which is unique because it doesn't have individual boards connected with each institution, it's very difficult for this inter-institutional union of students to try to come up with a student point of view. We met with them in Corvallis not very long ago, and we were talking about the matter of student participation on a board. And it was the consensus of those students who were there that actually a recent graduate would probably be in a better position if you look objectively at the problem. Students also serve in interinstitutional system-wide committees, such as those on incidental fees and housing and so forth. And I think one other thing needs to be said, sometimes, at least I detect this in, among students, a distrust of representative government. And they talk in terms of a participatory democracy, which means that you need, if you have to have an opinion expressed, and it needs to be expressed by 28,000 students, you have to go back and poll 28,000 people and ask them what they think, and then try to work this into a point of view. In a great many of the reports that I've been reading recently, and I would cite particularly one now called the Report on Campus Tensions by a committee headed by Saul Linowitz of the American Council on Education, I think the headings of the chapter are kind of revealing, because they say, A, what's troubling the faculty? B, what's troubling the students? C, what's troubling the administrators? D, what's troubling the trustees? The thing that's missing there, and I think conspicuously missing, is E, what's troubling the general public, the supporting public. And it's that voice that has, I think, a little more difficulty finding its way into the decision-making process of the institution. I think that one of the reasons that the Interim Committee on Education proposed individual boards at each one of the institutions was to try to get a larger voice for the supporting public, who, after all, really own and will support these institutions so long as they think that they're fulfilling a need of society. I think also there has been expressed many times, and by members of this assembly, the fact that the president of the institution really should have more authority to match the responsibility that he has. He is responsible every day for everything that goes on at his institution. And it seems to me that this would put the president in a rather strange position, because here would be a student from his institution, possibly, in a position to vote final approval or disapproval of a recommendation from his institution. They would even be in the position of casting a vote to terminate him. And it seems to me we have seen the position of president of colleges and universities eroded in this country. We've seen college presidents leave by the hundreds to go back to teaching or to join a foundation or to get someplace away from this kind of pressure. And I wonder whether putting a president in the Oregon state system, which has no individual board to whom he can turn, in the position of being responsible to a student from his institution would make that position any more attractive. I think we would be doing something at a time when the demand seems to be the other way to give the president more authority. We'd be putting it in a position of really diminishing his authority. As Mr. Lehman said, it certainly is not up to the Board of Higher Education to set the membership or the terms or the qualifications for the Board of Higher Education, because that certainly is a legislative decision. But it seems to me that the questions that Mr. Lehman has raised, and that I find that the notes that I've made, that I've raised too, are things that are very, very serious and would set our system off in the direction of building a constituent board, as Mr. Lehman has said. And the board hears these final appeals from faculty and from students in the matter of discipline, in the matter of termination of administrators, in the matter of residency, and certainly the faculty would also feel that they should have a position on the board. So would the classified employees, so would the alumni. I'm a minority member on the board. I never have felt that I represented women. I don't know how one would represent women. But I think that there would be a feeling that one should build a constituent board. Students say that a student on the board would be a morale builder, a kind of a symbol. And I would agree that that would be true. But the faculty would also say that a faculty member would be a morale builder and a symbol. And so would the classified employee. And so would the administrator. And it seems to be in all the literature that I read about what is a board member supposed to do. He's supposed to ask pertinent questions. And he's supposed to bring to this job wide reading, a great deal of time, a great deal of effort, and a certain amount of judgment. And I think the judgment of a student, as a student, who has known nothing else than being a student, possibly would not be the kind of breadth that would be needed. And then I think that it's a matter of time and a matter of continuity. And I know that I'm the only unemployed member of the Board of Higher Education, too. And I probably spend a part of every day of the week, including Sunday, reading and studying and writing letters and trying to do these things and attending meetings. I try to attend as many statewide, regional, national meetings as I can, often at, always at my own expense when it's not something that's officially done by the board. I find it necessary to employ at my own expense a secretary to do some of the letter writing and some of the filing and keeping the thing kind of straight. And I think that we would be putting a tremendous burden on a student to be in a position of trying to do these things at the same time that he carried a full load as a student. And as Mr. Raymond pointed out, the present rules do restrict, and I think 728 does the same thing. Board members should not be an employee of the state system. And I'm just wondering whether, if in fact there'd be a problem if a student named and someone the governor wanted to name was employed by the institution under a work study program or was working his way through school, would he be restricted? And it seems also that a student would have a very difficult time not representing his views as they were shaped at the institution from which he came. I guess when that is the place where you live, and that's the place where you work, and those are your friends, and that's the viewpoint that you get, and that's the newspaper you read, it's very difficult, it would seem to me, to get beyond the institution. And it does seem to me that as Mr. Lehman indicated, and as I have read in the literature, there is a feeling that boards of trustees generally are too old, or I think they put it that they are unwhite, unpoor, and un-something else, I've forgotten. And maybe, certainly, broadening the point of view on a board probably would bring additional points of view. But I think a recent graduate very well could stand back from the experience that he had and perhaps look at it a little bit more objectively than he would be if he were actually in the institution at that time going through his education. And as far as Mr. Raymond has mentioned the numbers of 10 members voting, I think one of the things Mrs. Dean has constantly been talking about is the move toward politicizing our institution and attempting to make decisions on matters that really are political rather than matters that involve the decision making within the institution, and this would possibly do this also. And I think as far as the gap between teacher and learner and parent and student and the older person and younger person, there has always been that. We try to arrive at accommodations. I think we need to hear each other's points of view. It would be a sterile performance on the Board of Higher Education if we didn't. But if there were not that gap between teacher and learner, then I think we have to ask, what are we in the business to do?
Thank you. Thank you very much. We have two other bills, which no one has signed. Senate Bill 702, Senate Bill 374, and Senate Bill 234. The only one that signed up is Senator Hartung. He's in a meeting. He will be here. I'll call for him to come shortly. Is there anyone here that would like to step on Senate Bill 234? Sure. While we're waiting, then, let's turn to Senate Bill 665. The bill. Senate Bill 665 is a bill for an administrator to change the requirements of the state engineer being an engineer and set along to be an administrator. I've talked to as many people as I can on this. No one seems to object, including now Representative Bassett.
The only thing that I think that it might be, off the record, we hear all the time, all the guys kept about Glenn Jackson. The engineer is a little bit independent under that pressure, but an administrator would be, would certainly be strictly.
Well, all right, chair moves and girls stand up, 665 to the whole committee with a new pastor.
I don't know.
Okay, you ready to vote?
Yep.
Let's call roll. Matt?
Hank?
No.
Dancemore?
No.
Howard?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye.
So ordered, I'll carry you.
How
about 656, the railroad over here?
What? 656, we had this well-drawn bill yesterday. We voted 2-2. Same Howard moves. Senate Bill 656 is supposed to make a new math recommendation. 656, it ought to be in the same section there.
Did we amend that for the 2 years?
2 years, okay. And you?
Has that one amendment that was included in
1123?
It should be on line 15 of page 2 instead of 4 of series 2.
It's right on the original bill. This is a misprint.
Is it right on the county map?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, I bet. There's one stick right here.
I have a letter, I know it's in there. E&E has control of it, and it should be 2 years instead of 4 years.
All right, well, the motion is passed. You Senate Bill 656. First call roll.
Edison?
No.
Dancemore?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
McPherson?
No.
Martin?
Aye. Thorne? Yeah. Representing Howard, I've got the bill. 432. And 432. Representing Anderson moves Senate Bill 432 to the floor of the full committee of the Dupas recommendation. Go on railroads and put them in order. Clerk, call the roll.
Edison?
Aye.
Dancemore?
Aye.
Howard?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Martin?
Aye. The order of representative, Senator Carrick, you want to hear it? There are three that have passed down from the chairman. What is Martin saying?
Well, he's done it. I couldn't get him, and I sent,
there are 10 to 131.
What is 137?
Now, somewhere in this hand, a whole bunch of amended comments to this bill. We're up at our desk, and she's probably right down here. Can you see if she has it?
Certainly sympathize. We've gone bent over backwards for the Pendleton Road so far this year. But to open this up to one veterans organization,
going to open up statewide.
The state is going to vote no. That's Colorado.
Anderson?
No.
Isnor?
No.
Howard?
No.
McPherson?
Aye.
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 Removed the agricultural exemption from the minimum wage, and now it brings the state law in compliance and conformance with the federal law. And on page 2, beginning at line 29, the new material through page 3, line 21, is what is known as the Green Amendments that were written by Congresswoman Edith Green in order that the orderly picking of crops in the Northwest would not be disrupted by the federal law. As you'll see, it exempts, basically it directs itself to the casual farm labor, the person that is picking strawberries or beans, and the youngsters that can't really probably justify or can't warrant paying them a minimum wage. And the last, on line 20 and 21, page 3, is what's known as the sheepherders exemption, where people working with livestock on the range may be on call 24 hours a day to look after that sort of livestock. I think each one of those exemptions are relatively easily understood, and that is a part of federal law, and that would bring Oregon's law in compliance. And on page 4, subsection 2, the committee felt that it should be spelled out what the minimum wage for an agricultural worker is, and that's written at $1.30. Now, this does create a little bit of an incongruity in our law, in that the state general minimum wage law is $1.25, so we have a situation here where the agricultural minimum wage is stated 5 cents higher. And this, we were told in committee that...
Is our minimum wage still $1.25?
My understanding. I think right now it's $1.25, and that's what our committee was told. I frankly didn't check it out.
I remember asking last question, maybe the friend didn't ask last time, increased to $1.50.
Oh, Mr. Gardner?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, may I?
Yes, $1.25 in state law.
Is that all increase in the future?
No.
Not that I have seen.
We were told that no one knew of any instance in the state where anyone engaged in agricultural work was being paid less than $1.30. Like most other industries, why competition for labor has made the going wage considerably higher than that. But that basically is what this bill does, Mr. Chairman. Please answer the question.
The only one I had is this, how does this affect
the
peace work? Well, whether they're paid by...
Peace work is exempt. Specifically exempt on page 3, line 2. That's a sub under sub 6.
Okay. Question, Senator Hartman.
I'd tell you to get back to work, but it won't do any good.
I'll try.
Thank you.